eyes, O Lord, save me, my God, deliver.
Welcome to The Firmly Planted Tree, a podcast dedicated to the reading of the Psalms for strength in our daily walk and to delight in the law of the Lord. I'm Joey Hawkins, and like the tree planted by the waters, may God's word establish you in righteousness.
The Lord alone deliverance sends, no other source of help have we.
All right. Well, joining me today is Raleigh Hawk. Raleigh is an elder here at First Christian Church in Anna. And maybe let him introduce a little bit more about himself in a moment. We'll go ahead and begin with the reading of the psalm, which will be Psalm chapter 2, again from the ESV translation. Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision, and he will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in his fury, saying, as for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. I will tell of the decree. The Lord said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage and the ends of the earth your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Now therefore, O kings, be wise. Be warned, O rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish in the way. For his wrath is quickly kindled. Blessed are all who take refuge in him. Alrighty, so bringing in and wanting to start early with this podcast with the idea that, again, the Psalms are read within the context of the church. They're sung within the church. And so sharing in this together where Raleigh and I can just kind of study this and share some thoughts that we have. So again, Raleigh, if you want to tell a little bit about yourself and any experience you feel like bringing to the Psalms, maybe what your experience has been before with it.
Yeah, so I guess I'll be a man and define myself by my work. That, in its purest form, I'm probably a consultant, which is a fancy way of saying that I'll pretty much do anything people will pay me to do. In my life right now, that's a lot of IT, it's a little bit of public relations. And then I do some other things that I don't get paid for, like the small role that I play in ministry and as an elder here at the church. My experience with Psalms, and it was one of the things I was wanting to say that I appreciate about you doing this series, is that my relationship with Psalms is probably a little different than most of the members of our congregation and most of the people we know. That when my family started going to church, I was around six. It was right after my parents split up, and it was kind of a dramatic time in our lives. And so we were going to some charismatic churches and kind of hopping over a few years to some different ones. And so with the Psalms, we literally sang a lot of them. That this was back in the era where you had the electric guitar and you had the transparency sheets and sometimes just throw a psalm up there and they'd have a tune for it and you'd sing them. And so in my mind, these were always just songs, and it wasn't until later in life that I've started to appreciate that there's actually a lot of theology going on in these things, and that mm-hmm. that it can be more than one thing at a time. So I feel kind of lacking in my knowledge of the Psalms. So again, I'm looking forward to all of this.
Yeah. So if you start with turn back here to the microphone. Sorry. I like the way Golden Gay titles this chapter in his commentary, because he has for Psalm 1 he has promises to keep in mind, and Psalm 2 he has promises to keep in mind part 2. Mm-hmm. And you sort of have this in the Septuagint reading and some of the old manuscripts. You would actually have Psalm 1 and 2 kind of combined, because you have the contrast between, again, a righteous man and then sort of the you know, raging nations and those who had set themselves up against God. But obviously this is a very politically charged psalm. Mm-hmm. And again, I think Golden Gate said some version that this might belong better in the book of Proverbs than it would in the Psalms itself. And so you start with two very unique Psalms in the whole book, with sort of laying out what the themes are about the righteous and the wicked, and you introduce the just more intense themes of the psalm. I cannot think of the word. I'm drawing a blank on it right now. Of like the, you know, basically of God laughing again that we see in verse 4, and this idea that of God's wrath, of his fury, of his him being in charge of all this. And so you have these elements that are coming to play.
Mm-hmm. One of the things in my own study of this that I read through the Golden Gate commentary, but then also was looking at the Faith Life Study Bible. It's a pretty good free resource, and where they're almost approaching this from opposite viewpoints. That what I was reading in Faith Life, it was saying how this is probably a psalm that would have been read during coronations and things like this. Yeah. Where Golden Gate says more that, well, when this would have come around, it was more during times of oppression.
Yeah. Well, and that's and that was, I think, Golden Gate again makes the comment that we don't know the exact timing of what's going on here. It just is this conversation with, you know, sort of with the Lord's anointed, with the kingdom that we have here. And I think again in Spurgeon's commentary, he, you know, draws this out as being very much a David a David psalm with talking that out. So yeah, it's. The context of it is certainly one of those we don't necessarily know, but it has that sense of what all the Psalms do, of the sense of like multiple meanings, where you have this meaning for what would be drawn out for the Davidic kingdom, the meaning drawn out for, like you said, the times of oppression when the Israelites were not in a place to, how should we say, break them with a rod of iron and dash them into pieces like a potter's vessel, like maybe they never were in that position. And then obviously it has fulfillment within Christ and the church that goes beyond that. And so, yeah, I don't know kind of what your overall take is on this, but I think on Sunday we've been in a sermon series through the book of Esther and talked a little bit about this, about one of the lessons from Esther is that God teaches us to laugh at hubris, like the pride of nations and those who would plot against God. And again, the picture that I used for that is like the idea of like you've got the kid who's mad, you know, swinging his arms, and dad like places his hand on the head, and you know, it's just a sort of like laughing scene where, you know, if you're in the position of the child swinging, like you have that sense of powerlessness, but it, you know, as you get older, you sort of have this like, hey, calm down, and you realize what those situations are for. But that's what we look at. Mm-hmm. That it initially starts with Psalm 2, with why do the nations rage and the people plot in vain, with a just implicit understanding that they don't have control over the things that they have, they mm-hmm. think that they have control over.
Yeah, kind of big picture here, as a 21st century Western world kind of person, we read some of this about God's fury and God laughing, and we blush a little bit at these things, and our perspective is so different that we don't have this heavy oppression that we're dealing with, and we all to varying degrees have this feeling of self-determination in our lives, and where I really try to put myself in the place of where if we were in a different sort of era where we would crave this sort of thing so much, where right now we're kind of like, okay, God, don't be too gaudy and mean to people.
Yeah, well, and we get uncomfortable with what it's like the idea of anthropomorphism, or like applying human characteristics mm-hmm. to God, like, oh, like, don't do that. Like God clearly wouldn't, you know, necessarily laugh, and he doesn't necessarily have wrath in that way. And we get uncomfortable with that, and I've got to find it again, but C.S. Lewis, you know, he had this in his book on it. He would talk about how, like, one thing he loves about the Psalms is that they are very much an earthy reminder. Like, they have this feel in Psalms, too. Again, you have this idea of, like, God sort of looking over the, you know, looking over creation. So I laugh because it just came to my mind. It's like the astronaut meme, you know, with the astronaut with the gun at the back mm-hmm. of the head of the other astronaut, sort of like it was, you know, like, so I was never in charge. And it's like, no, you never were in charge. I was in charge all along, kind of a thing where you get that feel from it. And yeah, when you talk about structure again, Spurgeon, and really what we'd see the natural structure, you have the first three verses being this nation's raging, and then verses 4-6 is the Lord deriding them, like sitting in heaven laughing at them. And then you have verses 7-9, and maybe even, 7-9, I would say, being the sort of declaration over the Son and the Son proclaiming this decree. And then verse 10 is just the final admonition and advice, shall we say. Maybe implicit threats would be better given to the kings of the earth. Which verse 12, you know, kiss the Son, and again, other translations understand that like that the idea is more of like true homage being paid. And again, we're, you know, kiss has a different meaning in a different context, but certainly in that time, you know, it's this idea of you paying true homage to someone, which again, it's this picture. It's like someone gets close enough to kiss you, it's a lot harder to conceal motives. And you know what I'm saying? Like you can still do it, but it's one of those things where it's like truly respect God and the role that He has, and especially the Son being the anointed one, or else He'll be angry. You'll perish on the way. So yeah, that's kind of the structure they have with that. We can take each of those passages, sort of the first three. You know, with this concept of and these questions I usually like to ask is like, what do these teach us about God? What do these teach us about man? Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, verses 1-3 is there's always this picture of rebellion against God. Like there's always that sense of wanting, and you can use that word self-determination. This is the dark side of self-determination.
Right. Yeah, and I don't want to derail this whole thing and just go crazy with divine counsel stuff and Deuteronomy 32 sort of stuff, but whenever I see nations, this is one of the things that really hits me, where without getting too complicated about it, in Deuteronomy 32 you have this sort of abridged version of the Babel story, and where a lot of translations will talk about the nations being divided according to the sons of Israel, where people with more of a divine counsel worldview prefer the translations that I would think are more accurate, where it says divided according to the number of the sons of God. And so where you have this notion that the sons of God were ruling over these nations, and so it's when I look at it in that context, it's so much more significant than just a bunch of countries out here warring against each other. These are nations that are controlled, the nations of the ancient world that are controlled by these spiritual beings that are referred to as the sons of God, and get into trouble in a number of situations. But where this is so much like you talked about in a sermon a few weeks ago, of how you've got these forces of evil, and that Satan is real, and that he is after us, but he's just kind of flailing out of control, and that it's a powerful image of God being able to laugh at that. Like, yes, this is serious, and our souls hang in the balance, but at the same time, Satan is not a big deal for God. This is not I think, as you put it, a yin and yang situation. Like, it's not even close.
Yeah, there's not like an opposite force, you know, that God is struggling with, in the sense of like how's this going to end? How's this going to turn out?
Yeah, and the struggle so much in my mind is more God allows the world to operate this way, so that, short version, that we have the opportunity to choose to love Him,
yes,
and to choose to have faith, and that all of this stuff that Satan gets to believe he's a big deal, these other dark forces get to believe they're a big deal, when really they're just small potatoes compared to all this, and we're going to rule over all of them.
Yeah. Well, and that's the image you get in chapter 6 of the king being set on Zion. Mm-hmm. The holy hill is this, you know, this drawing towards the Jerusalem picture that we have of being the city of God, of being the people of God, and yes, the governance of God in that sense, where it's like it doesn't, again, I can't help but read that with the New Testament in mind, with ultimately the picture of Revelation in mind, of the descending of the new heavens and the new earth, that in this sense that like again, God is king over all of that, and he rules over that, and he rules over it in such a different way than the plots and the raging of mm-hmm. the nations. And so when you see, you know, when you see good governance, then when you see good governance, you see the picture God set for what they should be. And of course, it feels like you rarely see good governance, mm-hmm. but that's supposed to be the picture then of the king ruling with this, in strength and glory and honor and goodness and righteousness that we so rarely see humanly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there's in that 4-6 section, I mean, there's a lot of significance to the language being used here, and kind of again continuing on the Deuteronomy 32 worldview, mm-hmm. that you have God effectively abandoning all these nations, and then okay, God is going to create his own nation, completely new through Abraham, mm-hmm. and that this is something completely different than what's taken place before, that he's not going to destroy the world again, that he's going to create this other new thing, and that so much of what happens over probably the next 1,000 years or so is just to create this nation, that so many of the rules and so many things that are taking place are all geared towards, let's create this massive nation of Israel. And then the language about the my holy hill, that I'm still struggling to learn to view things as a contemporary would have, even though we don't know exactly when this would have been written. But if I'm kind of an ancient Middle Eastern person, then how am I going to look at that? That this holy hill, it isn't just because it's cool to have a hill, have a city built on a hill strategically.
Yeah.
But that in the ancient world, that mountains were seen as this connection to the heavens.
Yeah.
And where when we think about mountains in a biblical context, we can almost think of that as an equivalent to Eden, where it's this place where you've got this overlap between the physical mm-hmm. realm and the spiritual realm. It's just a beautiful image when you think about it that way.
You can't get me started on mountains. The other ministers I'm friends with have a constant running joke because I preached a sermon, I guess, about 13, 14 months ago, leading up to Christmas, and I talked about the various peaks and mountains that yeah. make up the city of Jerusalem.
You were greedy because you talked about three mountains.
I did. I talked about three mountains. Settle down, Joey. And it's like, so I can never talk about mountains again for the rest of my life. But yeah, that's, and you're exactly right with that picture. And again, with God making his covenant. And it's interesting because you're continuing referring back to Genesis 11. It's 11, right? The Tower of Babel.
That's the longer version.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, 32 is where it's kind of the condensed version.
Yeah, but in I just taught my kids. We went through that passage with our Devo the other night, and I didn't blow their minds with divine counsel theory yet, but we'll get there someday.
It's really exciting right now because I've been interested in this divine counsel stuff for about 20 years. And it's only in probably the last 5 that I can actually talk to other people about it without being labeled as a heretic.
Yeah.
That obviously Dr. Michael Heiser is one of my big influences with this. But there's a lot of other people. And he'll be the first to say, I didn't discover this stuff.
Yeah.
This is all over the place.
Yeah.
And where people will start out with Genesis and let us make man in our image. In a Christian worldview, it's very natural to just say, okay, well, that's obviously the Trinity talking to themselves.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And where, okay, well, what would an ancient Hebrew have thought was going on there? Who do they think was talking to each other? Because it probably wasn't a Trinity, although you could make some binitarian arguments back then. But just our view of this stuff is so colored by our modern view where, you know, there were people reading this stuff before there were Christians.
Yeah, and that's, you know, and again, that's where you have these multiple layers of application and meaning ultimately applying to within the realm of the church, which is maybe where we'll get to when we get to the end. So in verses 7-9, then you have the decree being said. And these moments where you sort of have the Lord interjecting a decree, it's like this is actually the Son recounting what the Lord has said to them, and this is what we kind of see in the image of Christ being baptized and that voice coming, you are my son. We see this again, this language shows up in Revelation in the first part of Revelation, and Revelation the story of the dragon and the woman, that you have this idea of the father talking. And I was at a conference back at the beginning of the year, and I met ended up meeting a gentleman that was sitting next to me. Philip was his name, and we just started talking. And he said a really profound thing to me, and I want to hear what I wrote down. But he basically said, like, I want the loudest voice in my child's head to be their father's voice. He's like, to be my voice, in the sense that, like, and it was really drawing this image of kind of what you would think of with the prodigal son, where when the prodigal son is at his lowest, thinking, where do I go? You know, you would think, well, back, you know, in his mind, is like, back in my father's house, like, even the servants were treated better. But you know that there's that sense of being a father where it's like you speak things over your kids that someday you hope comes to fruition and comes to fulfillment. And, you know, some of that desire is ultimately, you know, manifested and demonstrated by God in how he speaks here of his anointed one, you know, as I said earlier. And so you've got this idea of David being the son of the Davidic line. But again, there's never this sense that verse 8 and 9, you know, of ask of me and I will make the nations your heritage, the ends of the earth your possession, that Israel ever had, a physical Israel ever had anything like that. Mm-hmm. They never did. And even, again, Golden Gate, I think he goes, yeah, he's like, the only one that I can think of that had anything like that contemporary would have, like, been Assyria, maybe. Mm-hmm. You know, and again, they were the ones ruling with a definite rod of iron. They were definitely crushing nations.
Well, once again, though, with the word nations being here, that if you think of it in this divine council context, that it's not necessarily about conquering them in the here and now, or even the there and then, if that's how you say it.
Yep.
But that ultimately these nations are going to be reclaimed for Yahweh, and just all this is going to happen. But so much like the Messiah coming and being so different than what they pictured, that they many of them would have expected him to come with the rod of iron and all that, and that really wasn't the form he was taking at that time. But another thing that I appreciate about this that I didn't earlier on, that it's typology, right? Not typography. That typology, that this wasn't a concept I was introduced to until probably the last 5 or 10 years. And just this idea of, I've heard it described as sort of nonverbal prophecy. Mm. And that you have this all over the place in Scripture, where you had New Testament authors going back and citing all of these Old Testament verses, and where they're finding Jesus in them.
Yep.
Where these weren't necessarily messianic verses,
yep,
but that there's so many levels that these things can be understood in. And then just this idea of whether it's David or Solomon or Adam, that you can be talking about the Son, that could be Jesus. It could also be these other guys that in their own way point to this perfect version, the Son of Man.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, that's in my mind, that's why whenever, it's like, what do you want to do? I mean, I remember going through, again, interpretation classes in Bible college, and you know, you got to interpret with, you know, what was the original audience thinking, things like that. And it's like, I remember the question coming to my time, like, how do the New Testament authors, like, interpret the Old Testament? Like, how did the apostles do that? And it was this sort of, like, under every rock and in every verse, you know, is this pointing towards Christ and fulfillment in Christ. I mean, how did Jesus himself, you know, talk about Scripture? And so it's like, if you find Christ in, like, a passage in the Old Testament, what am I going to do? Be like, you really need to look at the author's intent.
No, idiot.
Yeah, exactly. It's like,
God's not going to work in more than one way at the same time.
Yeah, come exactly. On. So, yeah. So you get to the last three verses then. Again, this sort of nice little three-verse section for each of them. But you have the, therefore, O kings, be wise, be warned, O rulers of the earth, this sort of threat. And again, Spurgeon is like, it's always wise to be willing to be instructed. And I'm like, that's one way to put it. Like, it feels a little bit more threatening than that, in the sense that it's like, understand the judgment that is coming if you're not doing this with a with an understanding of serving God. And again, we've gotten so used to, as a church, not talking politics, or when we talk politics, it gets so caught up in the two-party system, issues mm-hmm. of the day, things like that. When it's like, what if we instructed our rulers to say, hey, I'm a follower of Jesus Christ. Like, I'm a Christian, and I just want you to understand that you need to rule with wisdom and with fear of the mm-hmm. Lord, because He's in charge.
Yeah. One of the ways that Heiser will describe the divine council is that the heavenly realms have bureaucracy, which yeah. I hear that word and I cringe.
Yeah.
But again, it's one of these things that points to the imperfection, and that our version of these things is always going to be flawed.
Yeah.
But that this seems to be the way that God operates, that He could do all this Himself, but instead he's building some kind of family. And I don't understand all of it. I probably don't understand most of it.
And that's we get so uncomfortable because of the abuses, but implicit in the very creation mm-hmm. is order, is hierarchy, is mm-hmm. man first, woman created out of man. And again, you go, well, you know, we get offended in our modern understandings of these things, but it's like how does this get organized? Like mm-hmm. like God's got to organize too, and he's doing this in a perfect and righteous and holy way. Mm-hmm. And again, we have to understand that, like, that's what he's laying out yeah. here.
As if God needed Adam to name the animals, or needed yeah. him to go out and make the rest of the world like Eden.
Yeah.
But this has always been kind of the charge there, where he allows us to participate in his work. And that, for me, that's really when we talk about the being in the image of God, that's in the sense that we are his representatives here on earth, and we're here to do the work. And when we don't do that, whether it's where we fall short in the garden, or even at the Babel incident, which people try to turn this into all these different things, but at its root, you had people charged with replenishing the earth and yeah. choosing not to do that. And then we fall short, and there's consequences for that, and that God divides up the world. But as he's saying here, be warned, rulers.
Yeah. Well, and that's so to kind of draw us to a close, I want to do another Golden Gate quote. This is the end of his chapter on this. He says, living in a post-Christian era in the West means living in an era when the culture has thrown off the constraints of Christian faith. But the psalm promises that this will not be the end of the story. And so in that sense, the question I'd have for you then specifically is like, how do you feel like this... because again, with that, I think it's fair to say what Golden Gate is saying there is pretty accurate. Like, we would all agree that overall our culture is not dominated by the Christian faith anymore. Mm-hmm. So then how do we set up ourselves? How do we organize? How do we live? How do we conduct ourselves in the light of Psalm 2 in today's culture?
Mm-hmm. Well, I frequently find myself having to look at the world in the always but not yet context, where I don't want to fall into the trap that probably so many ancient Hebrews would have, thinking that mm-hmm. this moment with the rod of iron is just 10 years from now.
Yeah.
That whatever new political messiah we decide to pick in a few years, that, well, they're going to turn us back to a Christian nation and all that. And where
yeah.
maybe being a Christian nation is not even necessarily... the goal here, because God is going to reclaim all of the nations. It's yep. it's not just a matter of, well, we got to get America on board with this. Where I remember years ago, I was not particularly a Glenn Beck fan, but when he actually had a show on CNN International or something,
yeah.
and he had John Hagee on there, and I used to be a big Hagee fan until I got, you know, tired of some of the premillennial stuff that yeah. he was into. And I remember them
to the
talking
to the blood moons.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think I've
or pre blood moon.
Yeah, that they were going through some scripture, and Glenn Beck was asking him, well, why do we not see America in any of these ancient prophecies? And where Hagee's answer was kind of, well, maybe because we have a Democrat as president at this time. It's such a myopic yeah. view of this, that God doesn't need our political structures to operate, and that if we're if as Christians we are just this undercurrent of things and we never necessarily run stuff, that maybe that's good enough. And I don't know how much of that is in line with this, that certainly if I am in a ruling position, I hope that I kiss the Son and I hope that I do all these things. But outside of that, that this is all in God's hands anyway.
Well, and that's what time in human history outside of Christ's return would this psalm not apply to every ruler of the earth?
Right.
Like that's my thing. Like even if a Christian steps into a role, someone who professes Christ and is faithful, you still have to conduct yourself with the awareness of what Psalm 2 preaches until Christ returns.
Yeah. Like one of the conversations that I've had a lot in the last year regarding racial equity and all these other just with different maligned and disparate groups and how we come to terms with all this, and where I'll have people saying to me, well, you know, you got to get on board with this idea of institutionalized racism and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And where my response is, government is inherently evil, and that's not just a libertarian kind of thing, like in here.
Yeah.
Government not run by God himself is inherently going to be evil, and so why do we expect it not to be?
Yeah, exactly. Well, and that's it. And again, the kingdom of Israel, like as long as the Israelite and then the Judean kings later, like what the majority were wicked. Mm-hmm. And I mean, even the ones that were righteous and that, you know, had a man after God's own heart were still marked by wickedness and up. I mean, David being the picture is, you know, revolts, uprisings, you know, sons killing other sons, you know, and incest. I mean, just a mess, like the stuff that Samuel warned about when the people came to him and said, you know, your sons aren't good. We mm-hmm. want a king to rule.
Kind of coming of age in the Clinton era and the whole Monica Lewinsky situation and where people were losing their minds over this, and where I had Christian friends that were saying, well, you look at David, like he was a lot worse. He did some more wicked things than that.
I still remember, you know, again, hearing talk radio and things like that, and every time that the name Clinton would come up, I still distinctly remember my mom going, oh, that man, he's so wicked. And it was always just like this very intense thing. So, again, reading this psalm and the language of the psalms, like, again, you don't say, like, wicked. And it's like, well, it's, you know, it fits. So... Well, hey, I've really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you so much for stopping by and being willing to do this, especially early on in the process. Do want to just mention that as well. If you're connected with me, if there's a psalm that really you have a story around or that you have themes that you're interested in discussing, please contact me. Reach out to me through the various any number of different ways you can get a hold of me, and let's schedule something. Because again, this idea of the Psalms being the songbook of the church, the prayers of the church, the vocalization and expression of who we are and the emotions that we feel and the way we process life experience. Again, Psalm 2 is that politically, is that in the way that we look to God and trust in Him and His providence and His care for us and His control over all of the nations and all of human time. So again, thank you, Raleigh, for joining us and appreciate you sharing.
It's been a blast.
Thank you for listening. Find us online under the Firmly Planted Tree, where we can further continue our discussion. And please consider sharing this podcast and leaving a review. May the word of Christ dwell in you richly.
Joyful noise to make, oh, come with thanks His presence to, with joyful song.